Okay. Welcome, everybody. I'm really happy that you stay with me for this very, very brilliant time slot shortly before or after lunch. Yeah. So this is typically on conferences, you have two time slots that are the worst. One is the last one on the last day. Nobody's there anymore. And the other one is around food. Yeah, like you've completely lost when you have your session around food. But so thanks for being here. What I want to talk about today is the Open Submit project, which is my private little open source project for the last couple of years. And this was done in collaboration with some people from Potsdam, with people from here, from Chemnitz, from Technical University Chemnitz. And I would like to split this talk in two halves. First, I would like to talk about the tool itself and what this is about, this open source project, what is the reason behind from the university context. And in the second part, I will talk a little bit about open source technology, how it is used in this project, what my experience is with things such as Django and Python and web frameworks. So this is the idea. We split this in half roughly, and I try to keep the time so that we all get it done. Okay, what is my background? I'm a university researcher and teacher, and I checked my own CV and was really surprised to see that I meanwhile collect 13 years of experience with teaching, not with research. I conducted some courses meanwhile, courses with 5 people in the room, online courses with 6,000 participants. So over the years, I got a little bit of experience what it means to do university teaching. And the last case we had was at Technical University in winter semester, where we had an embedded programming course with roughly 300 students participating. And we had their assignments, code assignments to do. And the problem we solved with OpenSubmit was, how do you grade such assignments? Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the environment first. What does it mean when I say assignment? Most people here have a university background. So it's this typical homework you get. Yeah, you get a piece of paper, and then it says, hey, you have to solve this task and this task and this task, and then you get points. And these points may be relevant for your final grade in the course, so it's really crucial. All these points may, if you get enough of them, it may allow you to enter the exam, or it means nothing, you just do them freely to increase your knowledge. But what I learned over the years is that in many, many cases, these assignments are more important than the lectures themselves, because students really need this training and this practice and trying out things and not only listening to stuff like you do today. Yeah. So assignments are important. University knows this for decades. And this is an old traditional concept. So typically, you write your answers on a piece of paper and you hand it in. Today, you would do this, this as a PDF file. You place somewhere in a Dropbox, or you send by email. So there are mixed versions of this. And the tutors and the course owner then take your assignment solutions, and they correct it and they grade it. And then you get your result. So that's the idea of assignments. Pretty simple. At least it sounds pretty simple. The point is, this whole topic is very, very crucial for students. So when something goes wrong with your procedures and your assignments, they start to panic, especially shortly before the deadline. For written assignments, that's not so critical. But for coding assignments, this becomes an interesting problem. Why? I collected some evidence from the web. So I searched for instructions how to do electronic submissions in a university context. And if you just scan the words, you see things like use a special file name, place it in this folder, do the security access like this, do the writes like that. If you do this, then you will get no grade. Yeah. So there's a lot of people trying to solve this assignment submission problem, the solution submission problem, in one or the other way by using technical tools. And I heard from students that typically they have to adopt in each and every course how to do it right. So that's kind of an issue. And I had the same problem. It started with a parallel programming course in Potsdam, where we had OpenMP, OpenCL, all the stuff you want to train with the students. And we tried to figure out how to do this code assignments solution submission efficiently so that the students no longer panic and so that we have a better and easier job. And we faced a couple of problems, and these problems repeated over the years. That you get when you have coding assignments in the university context. The first problem is formats. you wouldn't imagine how creative students can become when it's about submitting stuff to other people. So when the task is write a C program doing Hello World, yeah, and add a makefile and send it to me. What you get is archives with complete Visual Studio folder, debug, release, mess, project, XML files, temporary files from the build, generated NMake files nobody can read, all these things. And inside this mess, you have to find the solution. Same holds for Eclipse, KDevelop, and all these other IDEs. Students today hate to use ordinary text editors. They want the full-fledged environment. And then they just take the project archive and send it to you. You get archive formats you never heard about. So I got S7Z. This is some ancient Mac compression format. Yeah. Okay, yeah, I can install all these tools and use them, but it's annoying. Yeah. RAW is something you don't want to see. Yeah? This is a commercial thing that somehow made it partly into the open source world, but at the end, it's not the best thing to choose. You have endless dependencies on third-party stuff. Yeah, on Stack Overflow, they say include math.h, so I do it too, or whatever. Yeah, including what I saw often is including GNU, bigint libraries, and all these things. Yeah, and then you have problems with third-party sources. Sometimes people take complete third-party libraries and include it into their solution in source. So you get like complete Git repositories as part of the student solution submission and everything. And this is a problem because it's always different. So you spend a surprisingly large amount of time in simply taking the student solution and making sense out of it in order to be able to grade it. It sounds like a small problem, but it actually eats up your time. And when the student number is going up, yeah, and you have hundreds of students instead of five, this becomes an issue. Okay. Second problem, reproducibility. That's obvious, right? If you have coding assignments and you go beyond ordinary C programming, it's really hard to make sure that the students develop in a comparable environment to the one where you grade and evaluate the code. So you see typical quote from emails I got, yeah, like, this is your fault, yeah, I got zero grade because my code is not working, but this is your fault, yeah, because on my environment, on my laptop, it worked. That's the classic, yeah. I have this weird message. It's like 3 hours before the deadline, yeah, I have this weird compiler message. You need to debug it for me, yeah, that's not my fault. I made everything right, yeah. I submitted the wrong file. I rely on some strange library and all these things. So this reproducibility of the environment where they do their code assignment isn't surprisingly relevant issue. And when you do, for example, parallel programming task where you want to do GPU programming or MPI in a cluster, then it becomes really, really nasty. What people in universities typically do is they provide you a test system. They say, hey, we have this machine XY is sitting in this room. If you submit something, it must run on this machine. Otherwise, no chance. The problem is, again, 3 hours before the deadline, everybody starts to panic and run to this machine and tries to fix their problem and debug it, yeah, because students start late. That you can't change that. Okay, so that's a problem. And the next problem is grading. Yeah, grading doesn't scale when you do it on paper format. So when you start to have a teaching team, multiple student tutors, instead of doing everything by yourself, if you have hundreds of students who want to have their feedback in time, who have maybe resubmissions, stuff they want to correct, things they forgot, then doing this manually really becomes tedious. Okay, another interesting point is cheating. Cheating is meanwhile also a problem. It wasn't that bad like 10 years ago. And the problem really is that you want to at least half automate the check for cheaters. I will talk about that later in detail. Okay, so this is like the problem environment, yeah, I got. This is like my daily work, and I sat there and said, okay, that's annoying. Let's fix that with a tool. And the first thing you always see then is Moodle. Yeah. Question, who knows Moodle? Hands up. Okay, half of the audience. Moodle is the most famous open source learning management system. Yeah, there are a lot of learning management systems that are intended to support university education, and Moodle is the one, the big open source product. And typically when you say, I have a problem with teaching, the answer is use Moodle. And there's a lot, really a lot of universities worldwide having installations and managing all their courses with that, not in Saxonia, but in many other parts of the world. And the question is now, okay, why don't you use Moodle and solve your problem there? And the point, we evaluated Moodle to fix that problems, and it turned out that Moodle and other learning management systems are all inclusive solutions. Yeah, they try to solve the world. So they do the course participant management for you, they do online learning for you, so you can create animated slide decks and manuals and everything. It's really, really powerful. You can do, of course, assignments, grading books, collaboration platforms, discussion forums, file management, course calendar, email list, everything. It's all in there, which means that my small little problem, assignment, is not their major problem. So it's not solved to that extent. And the second is a purely subjective thing. Moodle is written in PHP, and if you think about WordPress and Typo3 and other big PHP projects, you know that writing PHP plugins is a pain in the yeah. So nobody wants to do that. It's really, really, it's not fun. And so the idea of OpenSubmit was, let's write a small tool that allows to do assignment management only, and nothing else. And then we decided, we need some basic principles. Why is this different to other projects? And said, okay, the first thing we want to have is minimalism. Minimalism means instead of putting all the policies and rules and potential cases you may have for teaching in university context into the code, we want to leave that out and leave it to humans. So let me explain it with an example. A typical problem in university assignments is group work. You say, okay, we allow group work. And every teacher has different rules for group work. Some allow persons of two, some allow persons of three, some allow an arbitrary size, some allow one person groups, some not. Sometimes you can change the group during the semester, sometimes not. Yeah? And everybody has a different rule set for whatever reason. Yeah, didactic reasons, experience, doesn't matter. And if you want to press all of this into code with configuration options and buttons and everything, your tool becomes really, really complicated. And at the end, it looks like Moodle or something else. Yeah? So you really get something that is overly configurable and can do everything for you, but you spend like days on figuring out how to do it. And so what we try to do instead is to restrict everything to a reasonable size where policies are mostly implemented by humans. So this should be just a helper, yeah, not the implementation of your policy. The second thing is we want to have the most simple student interface you can imagine. Because as with all UIs, it's really, really hard to imagine what users think when they see your buttons and your text. And this is crucial for them, so let's stick to the minimum. On the other hand, we want to have something really powerful for the teachers. So that's a selfish tool. Yeah, it's mainly for my problem. Yeah? It maybe also helps the students, but it mainly solves my problem. Okay, so this leads to the fact that the student UI basically looks the same for years now. Yeah, you have an overview of your open assignments in your different courses. You see your deadline, what is the time left? Very important, this counter, like 6 hours left, 5 hours left, 4 hours left, yeah? They need that. Then you see your active submissions. This is stuff that you submitted where you wait for a result, for example, for grading. And then in lower part, you can also see your archived solutions from earlier times. And then you click on new submission, and then you get this empty thing where you can upload a file, and that's it. That's all you do. Yeah, really, really simple. So this is first principle, try to be minimalistic. The second thing is what I would call teacher-driven development. So we do something that is actually not recommended by software engineering courses. So if you read the books, they will tell you something different. Yeah, like make a plan, think about your features, requirements, user study. Yeah, we do the opposite. We basically develop features in the moment where we need them. Yeah, some people call that agile or design driven or whatever. It's just solving a problem. And the funny thing is, if you go to GitHub and look on our commit logs, you can actually identify the university semester times based on the commit numbers, which is really nice. Yeah. So if you want to do something like this in an open source project, like fast feature development, your project must be prepared for that. Your tools must support that. You need good testing strategies. You need very, very rock solid deployment strategies. No surprises, yeah, because if you update your submission framework in the middle of the course, what you don't want to see is strange exception messages floating around and stuff like this. So it should be predictable and very solid. This teacher-driven development actually led to the fact that in the back end, a lot of things is meanwhile supported. The red lines is just data protection of the students, yeah, so that you don't see their grades. So you have a lot of overviews and management capabilities and filtering capabilities to see what's going on with the gradings and with the student submissions in order to stay informed and manage the overall course in a better way. One example for this teacher-driven development, yeah, is duplicate detection. So in this course I talked about last semester with the embedded programming, we had a cheating problem. And the typical experience I have of cheating is that only bad students cheat. And if they do it, they cheat in a bad way. Yeah? So good students don't do that. They don't need to do that. They actually know the solution. But the bad students, they don't know this. Maybe they have a problem, time problem, or whatever. Yeah? Maybe it's not their fault. But then they try to cheat, and they're really bad in that. Yeah. So they don't invest a lot of time in cheating because it's half an hour before the deadline or whatever. Yeah? So what we did is we did a quick half-baked solution where we basically create MD5 sums of the files in the archive and put them together and use this as a checksum for the archive and see if somebody else submitted a similar thing. It turned out to work pretty well, by the way. Yeah. No statistics here, don't worry. And we added this in 2 weeks in the last semester, while the course was running, so that we really can cover this problem in the moment where it arrives. And later we want to fix that in a more serious way, like doing fuzzy comparison and a lot of elaborated features and cool stuff. But for the moment, that was good enough. Okay, so you can call it agile or whatever, but this is like the way how this project works in development, which is maybe not as it's supposed to be from the books. And the third thing is, the third principle besides this minimalism and the orientation on teachers is assignment validation. And this is the big difference to stuff like Moodle. What we do is, when people submit assignment solutions in the web interface, we basically allow them to be evaluated. Yeah, we call this validation. So student file uploads can be compiled on a test machine automatically. They can also be validated on the test machine automatically. And the feedback from this validation goes back to the student before the deadline. So the idea is you basically click upload, and then the interface says, hey, validation pending. And after a while, you get an email, hey, we validated your solution. There's a problem with that. Your archive format is wrong, or you're missing an important file, or the code doesn't compile on our test machine. Stuff like this. And they get this feedback, and they can resubmit as often as they want before the deadline until they reach the point where the tool says, validation passed. You got it. And then the student is happy because he gets this green button and he knows, yeah, I'm safe. I got my submission. I got my solution. Yeah. And the teacher is also safe because now he only gets solutions that are somehow pre-validated. Yeah, that you no longer have this mess with all the different formats and archives and the cluttering. Yeah, it more or less all works. And you can see the test results. And this is a good foundation to do your own manual grading. If you want to have more information about what is going on with the student submission, there's a third concept called full test, which you can run independently from the validation or after the deadline. This is not shown to the students. It's a separate test script. And the idea here is that you can give a performance numbers, check for specific keywords, yeah, stuff that you don't want the students to see, that this is your grading strategy. Yeah. Honest stories from teacher work. So this validation script is obviously something that is written by the assignment creator. And the Open Submit project distinguishes between the web front end and the executor daemons. And the executor daemons simply download the student submission and the validation script that was written by the assignment creator. They compile it, they run it, and then standard out is sent back to the student. That's pretty simple, yeah? No big magic, it's easy enough. So whatever you want to do in validation, you basically write a Python or Perl script or Bash script or whatever. If you give back exit code 0, this means student solution is okay. If not, then this tool, submit tool knows there's a problem here. And whatever you want to tell to the student, you just print on the screen. And then standard out goes back to the student. That's the third idea. So from student perspective, this looks like this. Yeah, you get like compilation test result and validity test result, and this tells you, yeah, everything is all right. Oh, wait, we have a problem here. And the teacher sees the same information. So he sees, okay, we got a compilation test and the output is this, and we get a validation test and the output is this, and we maybe got a full test and the output is this. Then we have an inbuilt archive functionality where you can do a preview in the browser. You wouldn't imagine how much time this saves to not download and unpack zip files and look into them, but instead clicking on them in the browser. This saves you like 30 seconds per submission. If you have 1,200 of them, this really adds up. Yeah, so it's these little small things that developed over time. Okay, so that's the basic idea of the tool. So we have two main concepts here. We have the assignments that relate to a course. Assignments may have a soft deadline, which is also something I learned in teaching. We distinguish between soft and hard deadline. Soft deadline is the one that is shown to the students, and hard deadline is the real one. Because what you always have is people submitting half an hour after deadline, always. And you always get this email, hey, I'm half an hour late because my AOL internet dial-up access was broken and now I can no longer work. Could you please accept it? And then you put it into the system and yeah. And in order to avoid that, what we did is basically to say, hey, we show some deadline to the students and for some period, typically it in my course is 24 hours, after that you can still submit, even though the counter is zero. That's pure psychology and it works amazingly well. Yeah, I never got such an email again. Yeah. Okay, so and we have all the scripts and grading schemes and so on. Then we have the submissions from the data model point of view. Group or submission groups are handled by the students. So if the student submits something, he can say, hey, this and this and that, these are my colleagues. I wrote the solution with them together. So we have no group management interface, nothing like this. We just say, choose your colleagues. And then the teacher afterward can decide if this is according to some group policy or not. Yeah. So this is one of the examples where we basically do not include a feature in order to stay flexible. Okay. And the status from student and tutor perspective obviously then looks different. So in the code, this looks like this, that you have different internal states for a submission. And the text shown in the interface is completely different in the teacher backend and in the student frontend. So when, for example, in the teacher backend, you have the test full pending status, so that the pending test is actually executed on some test machine, then the student just sees waiting for grading. Yeah, for the student, it looks like he just waits for a grade, but in the back, there's still action going on. Okay, so this is like a short sneak into what the tool actually does. We have a long feature list. Yeah, you can read them offline. Basically, I showed you some parts of this. The main message here is we constantly increase the number of features according to actual needs we get in practice. Yeah, so there's nothing like arbitrary stuff put in. Maybe that's useful. We just do it in the moment where we need it. Okay, so how does that help you with these 1,200 submissions? And the main message here is it only improves your workflow. That's the only thing. There's no big magic here. We just make everything organized and structured. And we initially thought this is only helpful for teachers. But what I always hear from students is they really like that. And the thing they like is that they get this validation, that somebody says to them, thumbs up, what you submitted is gradable. Yeah, you will not get 0 points for that because you achieved something. That's really, really good for them. They like that. Yeah? And that's a small part of this tool, but it's actually for them also an advantage. When I talk about this tool, then I also often get the question about automated grading. Because when you see all this, then you think, hey, you have validation scripts and standardized procedures. Why not creating points for this result automatically? This would even more improve your work even more. You could get even faster results. Yeah, everybody submits and then they automatically get their grade. And this is a problem. I'm still fighting with people. I get this request from MOOCs also, massive online courses. Yeah, they also want to have that. With 6,000 people, we can no longer do manual grading. The problem with this whole thing is that deciding on a student grade is something where you really have to take care about of a lot of details. So if you want to automate that, you have to restrict the style of assignment you can do to make it checkable, to make it really gradable in an objective way. Because you decide about student futures here, yeah? Student exams here. So this is not fun. This must be really serious. It's also a legal problem, by the way. Yeah. So automating this completely is, I would say, not really possible in real life. Yeah. It sounds like a good idea, but in real life, when you want to do this with real courses and real studies, maybe it will never work. Yeah. And therefore, Open Submit tries to at least help with all the other things, so that the actual grading, looking on the code and deciding on points or something that you get for this, that this becomes as easy as possible for humans. That's the philosophy we developed over time. Okay, questions about that? That's the general story about the tool itself. Yeah, like the, yeah?
Have I understood right? You also execute the submitted problems, or do you only compile them?
Yeah, we also execute them. So we do. Yes. Comes later, yeah? But there's a reason why this is not happening on the web server, obviously, yeah? The basic idea is that the test script written by the assignment creator, yeah? This script runs the student code. So when you say our assignment is to do a bit shift in C, and then you say, okay, write a bit shift in C and print your result on the screen. Then you can read standard out from your fork process, yeah, analyze it, see, okay, looks good. And then you say in the validation output, hey, looks fine, you created the right output. If you do security-related stuff, yeah, the question is, again, what is the assignment? Yeah, and if the assignment is security, I don't know, rootkit tests or whatever, then basically you should do something with your execution hosts. Yeah. Virtual machines in a protected environment, no networking, yes, things like this. When you want to prevent students from doing nasty things, like submitting a rootkit installer instead of a binary bit shift, which is possible, yeah. This is again a question of infrastructure protection. So OpenSubmit does not solve this problem for you, yeah, because my personal opinion is this is well understood, yeah. So in Linux, and in general open source software, it's well understood how to set up a safe execution environment. So if you think that this is your problem, yeah, you should set up your execution host accordingly, like isolated network, yeah, and so on. The only thing that the execution hosts need is outbound connection to the web server to pull for some job. That's it. I come to that later, okay? So I give you all the details, but in general, that's the message. Yeah, if you need protection from bad student code, do it on the host level and not on the execution level. Somebody saw that picture and told me, "Hey, that's the perfect virus spreading platform." Yeah, but okay, good. So let's talk about technical details. Technology. So maybe first the web part. Yeah, the web part is a Django web application. We started with Django 1.3. Which feels like decades ago. Yeah. Meanwhile, we are at Django 1.9. Question, who knows Django? Okay, half of the audience. So Django is a small introduction, but it's a web development framework, like Zope, like all the others. Yeah. There's actually a booth downstairs, a Django booth. You can talk with these people. And it's a web framework that supports you in writing web applications in Python. So you have a template engine where you can actually create HTML pages on the fly. You have an object relational manager where you can write Python classes and they translate to database tables automatically. You have query processing where you basically ask your model objects for something instead of writing SQL queries. You have support, security support, HTTP handling. So common stuff that you actually expect today from a web framework. Yeah? There are multiple of them for different languages. In Java world, this would be something like Tomcat and Servlets. Yeah, so each language has its own web framework, like heroes. And in the Python world, Django is very common. And we decided for that because we really love Python. This is one, was one of the main reasons. And we stick with that until today. We still stick with Python 2.7. You know that Python 3 is here to stay, and Python 2 will go away. And so it's a question of time, when do we migrate? But not so far, yeah, because packages are still there, everything is running, so there is no need to do that. Yeah. ModWhisky, Apache, and Postgres. So that's a standard web framework setup in the open source world, no surprises here. And we use some third-party code, including strange JavaScript libraries for the UI action, and that's it. So yeah, kind of boring. And we got some experiences by doing this web framework development over the years. And the first thing that maybe is interesting here for you and on this conference is the question of third-party code. So let's imagine you write this application here and you want to do authentication. So you want to know who is this guy sitting in front of my application. Django has inbuilt authentication with username and password. And honestly speaking, that's terrible. I no longer want to have 20, 30, 40 accounts in each and every web application, so we wanted to have something better. Social login with OAuth, meaning that you can use your Google account in order to log into the application. Maybe your university has institute-specific authentication. So how do you do that? And there, as with all these problems, there are two choices. Either you do it by yourself, or you use a third-party library. Question, what for the audience, who is using third-party code as like first choice when you have a problem? Okay, and the others, develop it by yourself before using other people's code? Nobody. Okay. And so this problem is always there, right? The question is, what do you do? And when you talk to software industry, it's not common. If you see how Google is handling this problem, how companies like IBM are handling this problem, yeah. If you use other people's libraries, this is good because they maintain the product for you. They maintain the library. They fix the security bugs. They give you new features. Yeah. So that's an advantage. On the other hand, if it's not working, you're really in trouble because then you no longer have only to understand your own project, but also the other people's project, in order to create a patch or to and make a pull request. And you have to be nice and kind in order to get your pull request through. And it takes not days, but it takes months until it gets into the product. So you're working with a fixed version of the third-party library, which is bad. So you put the sources into your own repository. So it's messing up, yeah? And therefore, some people say, hey, it's easier to solve this by myself. And everybody has this problem, and actually, we saw this and that cases here in OpenSubmit. Yeah? So you always have this maintenance problem, either with your own self-developed solution or with the other people's solution. And sometimes it pays off and sometimes not. Specific example, versioning. Yeah? In OpenSubmit, we have the problem that students can update their submission. So we have something like versions of the same thing. So there are now two ways to do that. Either you use an existing framework to do model versions. This is called Django Reversion, works pretty well. Or you do it by yourself, like implementing a version number and counting it up. And so we are still sticked with our custom implementation because it's easy and works pretty well. Maybe we should change, I don't know. API implementation. Today you need a decent JSON API in your web app. How to do that? Do you use an API framework, like Django REST framework here in this world? Or do you do your own custom HTTP API? Maintenance versus third-party code. So we are still stick with the custom HTTP API, but normally you don't know. Yeah? And what we learned after a while as decision criteria is that first, when you want to use a third-party library, yeah, you're considering it, then really check for the meta properties, like how old is this project? How many contributors? Last commit, yeah? You know this line in GitHub when they say last commit 3 years ago, then you can stop, basically. Yeah? Number of people using this, and so on. And DjangoPackages.com is in Django world a perfect source because it basically does exactly that. It gives you for authentication, frame templating, file management, everything. It gives you comparison tables and says, hey, here are these 5, 6, 7 projects offering solutions for that. And these are the statistics, GitHub commits, contributors, and so on. So this gives you a very clear indication about the maturity of a third-party project. And then you may decide to use it or not. Yeah?
There's a third option, I think.
Okay.
If you find the last line being 3 years ago, but still think that the code is decent, you can fork or continue in the development.
Yeah, that's
so you don't have to start from scratch.
That's true. That's also an option. But I would actually count this as developing it by yourself, because you have to get into this project, you have to understand it completely, you have to follow their procedure. Yeah. The point is, I'm talking here more like a guy doing a hobby project in spare time. Yeah. So for me, this is also a question of time management. You're right. Yeah, that's a good solution. It's open source, actually. It's the better solution than doing it by yourself anyway. Yeah. But the effort is the same. But yeah, correctly. And the second thing we learned is if something tells you that it does advanced magic, better be careful. Like, we do everything automatically and for free, and it costs you no performance, and it always works. Yeah? That's sometimes an issue. We saw that, for example, with model versioning tools. Okay, second thing, data migration. If you use a web framework, if you use an object relational manager, so something that is translating programming language classes into database tables, then you have an interesting problem with updates. Yeah. So you have now your project, you have your data model, you decided, for example, that in the submission class, which is the database representation of a student submission, there's a particular attribute, and after a while you figure out, maybe we need another 3 or 4 or 5 of them, and they are not always filled out, and this becomes messy, and I want to restructure the model now. Yeah, I want to put this into this model class, and then this should become a separate table. And yeah, so this is called data migration, and it's supported by Django. In earlier times, before Django 1.7, you needed extra tooling for that. Since Django 1.7, it's included. Other frameworks do that too. In Ruby world, this is also possible. And the interesting point about these data migration frameworks is that they only take care of model migration. So they are really good in renaming your tables according to how the classes look like. Yeah, like creating columns, deleting columns, renaming tables, and so on. What they don't do for you is data migration. So they don't take the old data in all cases and put it into the new tables at the right place. So if you do these data model transitions inside such a project and you have live running systems that you don't want to destroy or where you can throw away everything, this is nasty and it eats up a lot of time. The tools try to help you with that, but what we experienced now after these years is you should create your data models in a way that they are migration friendly. So you should consider from the very beginning the fact that things will change. Some people say the answer for that is no SQL databases and simply leaving out relational tables at all. Yeah? Depends, but this is something you need to have in mind. Sometimes maybe it's better to leave the model as it is and do your work in the query processing. So if you, for example, say, hey, I need it's a different way through my models to come from this attribute and this record to this record, you could change your data tables accordingly, like you learned in your database course, or you can just use reverse lookups, smart query processing, where you get a little bit of more SQL in the back end, but it actually solves your problem more easily. So data migration is a surprising pain point after a while. Web authentication, I talked about it. I will skip here over this quickly. Basically, we learned that authentication is another thing you should never change. If you change your authentication system under the hood, your user accounts become duplicated. You need migration strategies for that. Identity mapping on emails no longer works because people have like 20 email addresses and come with a different one every time they log in. So yeah, this is also a pain point. Okay, let's come to your problem, maybe a little bit more detail. So the execution host. The current executor is just a single Python-free script, nothing else. We did it in a way that it uses HTTP libraries in Python to download student code and the validators from the web server. So it's basically like a poor man job management cluster system. And this script is called by cron like every minute. And the isolation is not handled in the executor. The only thing that the executor makes sure is that you have a proper download and a result reporting according to what's going on when the code is executed. But it tries to stay generic in a way that in the moment when the validator script is started, yeah, the responsibility stops. It just catches the output and that's it. Because, as I said before, it seems to be much easier to solve all your security and scalability issues outside of this thing instead of putting everything into this single little script. Yeah. So if you, yeah, that's about, if you, for example, say isolation is really crucial, then you must make sure that the only IP tables allowed connection is the one to the web server, and that's it. Of course, there's still an attack vector here. Yeah? So students could try to get into your web application, find a flaw in the API design, and use the flaw in the API design to actually overwrite gradings of other people. So this is something where we took a lot of care of. We have special test cases for that. Yeah, a lot of coverage here in this part of the project because we know that this is crucial. But from our perspective, that's the only attack vector. That's the only thing. Yeah? If you handle that right, if you protect the database from the executors through the API, then everything is fine. For the infrastructure environment, for dealing with malicious student code, do something on your hosts. Yeah. So in here in TU Chemnitz, for example, we operate a Proxmox installation where we can, with API calls, create virtual machines on the fly. Yeah. And these and there are clones of images. And in this image, the executor daemon is automatically started. And that's it. Yeah, so no surprises. One thing I hear a lot is, why do you do this pulling model? Yeah, where we basically pull the web server every minute on the executor side. Do you have new work for me? Why don't you do sophisticated message queuing stuff or push model or whatever? And the problem here is, if you want to put the communication into this way, saying the web server is delivering work to the executors, then you need an open hole, yeah, in the network of executors. And this is really not nice. So we want to avoid that. Second thing, this is trivial to implement, yeah, and trivial to debug. When you have just a cron job doing HTTP requests every minute, you can clearly see in the Apache logs who connected when, yeah, what happened on the executor side. So it's very, very easy. And for this scale of application, it's good enough. So the largest throughput I got was like hundreds of submissions pending, yeah, in the last hour before deadline. And then we set up more VMs. So you better scale out. Yeah? You make more VMs, then they fetch in parallel. And if everybody's fetching every minute, you still have no problem. OK. So that's the general architecture questions. Yeah? Yeah.
Maybe you can lose a few words on how you're doing unit testing or integration testing. Have there been any guidelines?
Yeah, okay. Okay, so unit testing here in this project works with the default Python/Django mechanisms. So Django has a separate chapter on how to test web applications. It's well supported in the framework in the sense that they offer you something that's called a test client. That's a programmatic thing where you can simulate a web browser connecting to your application inside of your unit test. And with this client, you can do arbitrary get and post calls and see what happens. And so what we do is we created attack cases that may happen, yeah, from the client side. And we use the Django test client in order to trigger these requests and then make the according assertions if the web application code acts correctly or not. Most of these cases basically are the question, the web application gets this request in this context. For example, you access a submission that doesn't belong to you. There should be an HTTP 500. There should be an according error code as an answer. That's the level of protection we have here. And this is what we do. Yeah? Coverage means that we basically make sure that all the API code is handled, yeah, in test coverage. I think we are pretty close to 100%. I don't have the number in mind now. But this is how we want to protect from this. The second thing, we do a lot of versioning and logging. So we typically don't throw away stuff. For example, if students update their submissions, the old version remains in the database. This is to have the possibility to follow up. Yeah, so we had one security incident in Potsdam where basically we just looked, okay, what was the user, what did he submit before, okay, it looked like this, and here he decided to submit something nasty. So if you protect your database, again, everything is fine. You must make sure that your API code is solid and that your database is protected, and then you're good. Okay, last words. I have two slides about regrettable things and things done right from my very private perspective, yeah? So if I could turn back time and start over again with this project, which I will not do because we spend too much time on this. There are some things I would do better in my next project, and maybe this is also interesting for you. OpenSubmit has no central state transition logic. So this is a lot about submission states and assignment states. And even though states are centrally defined, the transition logic, when do I change the state of a submission, under which conditions, is scattered in the code. It's here and there and there. And if you do this API call, then the state changes to this. And yeah. And at the beginning, this was OK. But meanwhile, it's really, really hard to understand by one look on the code, OK, here something is going on. Here the state is changing. So if I next time I would implement a good state machine centrally so that you really have one place in the code where you see, okay, if this event happens, then this state change should be done to the submission. The second thing is view-driven development. What I mean by this is that Django encourages you to implement web views, pages, and write the according business logic behind. This goes pretty well and pretty fast. The problem is that this becomes increasingly less useful in times where people expect JavaScript magic, like stuff popping up, auto completion, yeah, and all these things that rely on an API in the background. So if I would start over with web development again, I would focus on API first instead of views first. So before you do anything else, first develop a good API that is programmatically usable for your functionality, and then you put the front end on top of it. Because you will need this API anyway later. It will come. Don't worry. Yeah. And so if you do this from the very beginning, you can avoid nasty hacks in your own code. Configuration management is a disaster in Django, I think. Yeah. So this is really, really bad. Like, what are the different options for my applications and how can I set them and how do they differ between debug and production mode? This is terrible. Yeah, this must be better. And forgetting the system administrators is also nasty. Yeah, so we ignored people running the installations for a long time, but they're really crucial. They keep your project alive. So give them command line tools, give them documentation, give them release notes, make them happy so that they keep your product up and running. Okay, and some other stuff. Things done right, and I expect criticism here. Yeah, I ignore performance completely. I don't care. I start to take care of performance in the moment where the problem occurs. And this was really, really rare. It was like two or three times in the last years. Yeah. Besides that, machines are powerful. Yeah, you just use the resources. See where you end up. This works for this application. If you write a database, maybe that's not a good idea, but in this application, it works. PEP 8, coding guides, I completely ignored them. The code looks like a mess, but it works. So yeah, who cares? If I have 50 developers, that's maybe an issue, but here in this project, it's okay. Python, Django, Postgres, they just do the job, so nothing additional here. Django is still awesome. It was awesome 5 years ago, and it's still awesome because it takes away a lot of bell and whistles from your work. Yes, stuff you don't want to take care about. It's also a protection layer. I would call it a stupidity protection layer. Yeah, things that you do wrong in web development, like cross-site script forgery problems and all these things. They have inbuilt mechanisms and guides, and if you just follow the book, it will protect you from that. So that's really helpful. Yeah, they also have a healthy deprecation ratio. So sometimes they deprecate features, sometimes they add features. But this is all very, let's say, predictable. Yeah, you get warnings about, okay, what will break in your code if you don't change that in the second next version and things like this. And this is pretty well done. I don't know about other frameworks, but this is pretty nice, and it helps you to keep your application compatible also to future versions. Another thing that you face, and this is the last one promised, is bike shedding. Who knows bike shedding? The term? Okay. For the others, bike shedding is the story where the term comes from, that people in the committee once wanted to build a housing for, I think, bicycles. And there was the question, where do we build it, and what is the height, and yeah, inside, and how do we do access? But this was all not discussed. The only thing the people discussed was the color of the walls, yeah, and nothing else. And this is bike shedding, basically debating about trivial things forever instead of focusing on this stuff. And what I faced is that in the moment where you do open source and projects for other people, you will get that problem. Yeah, people spend ages in your issue tracker on discussing about naming conventions for methods or things like this, because for them it's really, really urgent. And this is where you as a project maintainer must step in and be nice and gentle and say no. Yeah, because I think from a general perspective that that's a bad idea, or yeah, I don't know, we did this always like this and I like, or whatever your argumentation is, but you face this problem after a while. And since this is open source, you can always say, okay, if you don't like it, make a fork and try it by yourself, good luck. Yeah, it happened. Okay, yeah, so conclusion. From my perspective, OpenSubmit is a tool that tries to bring the keep it simple and stupid principle to learning management. Yeah, we do an application that just is responsible for one thing, and as you saw, it's still surprisingly complex and big meanwhile. As somebody who's mainly paid for university work, I can tell that doing your spare time project is a lot of fun, and I really recommend it. But the two things that happen is that you create technical debt if people use your tool, and the second is if you want them to use it, if you want to be popular or rich or whatever from your project, yeah, then you need advertising, and this was basically what I did today. So hopefully this is an interesting project for you, and maybe you're interested in collaboration or at least testing it. I'm open for questions, and so far thanks for the attention. Questions? Anything? No? Yeah?
You mentioned the teacher-driven development as an example for agile development. Would you say that that's a typical example? Is it the way agile development should be done?
I mean, this was like a joke, yeah? Okay, so agile is a lot more. Yeah, agile is also about having frequent short meetings and doing test-driven development and everything, yeah? What I mean here is that I hear people stating, so if you Google design thinking in the web, you will find a lot of company pages where people tell you, hey, we have a fantastic idea how to do a revolution in software development. We think about the users first. And it's like, what? Yeah? So the classical software engineering, like waterfall model, writing a requirements document, yeah, it looks good in the books, it looks good in the theory, but in practice, when you do something like this, yeah, and when you want to solve a problem, you need faster turnaround cycles. And open source software, here, the one we use, actually helps with that. We could now take an agile development process from the books and apply it to this project. But yeah, there would be no big advantage. Basically, you need that if you become larger, if you have more developers. Yeah, and the question is, can you keep with that model that we do here? And the answer is, if you do agile in the right way, then yes. Yeah? So the main message is, thinking about your users first sounds trivial, but is for a lot of people a new idea. Industrial software development works differently, if you think about that. Yeah? So here it's purely user-driven. User has a problem, solve it directly. Okay, other questions? Did I answer your security question correctly? Yeah. So, okay. Yeah.
Well, it's not really a question, but a comment. So I'm a Linux kernel maintainer. And I have the problem of having lots of people sending me code, which I need to review, or someone needs to review. Mm-hmm. And so I think I thought your talk was quite inspiring, and I just want to mention that in the world there are similar people having this problem of having lots of code,
okay,
and having that reviewed, and that the interaction between these people and how they solve the problem is, I think, is pretty fruitful. So thanks for the talk. And
thanks. That's very interesting, because before we started with this tool, the first idea was to actually use an issue tracker to solve the same problem. Yeah, take an issue tracker and attach automated code execution to the issue attachment. Yeah, and which is like, I mean, this is basically an issue tracker with different servers. But the point, that the difference meanwhile is here, despite this automated testing, that we make this harsh separation between student front end, extremely simple, extremely trivial, yeah, and all the complexity in the back. And this is something you don't have with an ordinary issue tracker. So if I, Bugzilla, yeah, if I take Bugzilla and I try to understand what the interface tries to tell me, you need some training, yeah? And this is something that is different. Besides that, I don't know, maybe it would be a good idea to take issue tracking projects or whatever and just add this test execution idea and nothing else. Maybe that already solves part of your problem.
For example, what some kernel developers use is Patchwork, which is not an issue tracker per se, but a program scanning mailing lists for patches, presenting them in a list, and so you as a maintainer can set also this patch to is under review, is accepted, is rejected. So a contributor has also an easy web interface to see what the state of the patch is.
Okay.
So this is also a very specialized case, but
yeah. So sounds interesting.
Yeah. I think we face similar problems, and I just found that it's pretty fruitful to do well.
Yeah, thank you.
Over the edge.
Interesting to know.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, then. Thank you very much for your attention.